interesting concept here that Deleuze and Guattari in Anti-Oedipus come across is, and they're quoting Spinoza actually, why do men fight for their servitude stubbornly as though it were their own salvation? I mean, Reich actually writes, the astonishing thing is not that some people steal or that others occasionally go out and strike. It's rather that all those who are starving do not steal at a regular practice, and all those who are exploited are not continually out on strike after centuries of exploitation. Why do people still tolerate being humiliated and enslaved? To such a point, indeed, that they actually want humiliation and slavery, not only for themselves, but for others. You know, for Wilhelm Reich, the plague of neurosis is bred during three principal phases of life: childhood, puberty, and adulthood. And the family is key to all this. Basically saying the family kills the spontaneous vital impulses by the process of education in the interest of dubious refinement. And in puberty, each new generation is made submissive and conformist and sufficiently inhibited to accept meekly the limitations imposed by the institution of monogamous compulsive marriage. So what happened in Israel was basically, I think they were trying to apply some ideas of Marx, Freud, and Wilhelm Reich in the kibbutz. I mean, basically, the kibbutzes were first established in 1909. The first kibbutz was 1909, where 12 kibbutz in sorted one near the Sea of Galilee, called Degania. It's basically, the initial kibbutzes were actually influenced by Kropotkin's anarchist communism. And what carried these people from Europe to Palestine was the desire to build a classless society, a commune based on self-management, equality, and Jewish-Arab cooperation. The Hashoma Hatzair, known as the Young Guard, they were closely linked to the kibbutzim. Basically, they adopted Marxist socialism at the 1924 conference. They became allied with the Socialist League of Palestine and were part of the International Revolutionary Marxist Centre, who I've not heard of, but basically were an anti-Third International grouping. So what we have in the kibbutz is trying to liberate women from what was called her biological tragedy, the obligation of a woman to bear and raise children. So basically a woman would be freed from the chores of raising children. There would be collective care of children, housekeeping and laundry. So there'd be no economic dependence on the husband because basically there was no actual money in these original kibbutzes. And collective upbringing of the children, I think, is one of the most revolutionary aspects of the kibbutzim. Basically, almost from day one after birth, children were brought up in their own age group in a separate house, the children's house. I mean, there were various types of children's houses depending on the age group. Basically, obviously, mother would visit regularly until the child was weaned. And then after that, the parents would visit for only a couple of hours per day. Basically, this was hoped to build a moderate and harmonious relationship with parents and also to develop quality time. This is, I think, where you get the idea of quality time coming from. Because basically, it would be quality time if you didn't see your kids for like most of the 24 hours. So basically, the kibbutz educational program and this collective upbringing is basically trying to... Basically, try and get rid of the Oedipus complex, and because that is the root of most neuroses, and to lessen it. And also, they wanted children to learn a larger meaning of the word home. So like the kibbutz itself, the collective, the commune, not just the house of the parents. And also, it was also a character-building exercise, and basically to establish a Marxist Zionist worldview. And also to develop a collective identity versus individuality. There are a few quotes from some people who lived on kibbutzes and were actually brought up collectively. One said, "Our childhoods were full of beauty. We were children of nature. You'd run in the fields. The learning programs were a pleasure. And one of the first children to be born at Degania recalled in later life a happy childhood during which the mutual concern for one another nurtured from the earliest age to the point it became intuitive. An impulse that the individual obeyed instinctively meant that it never occurred to me that I should have an orange and not share it with all the children." The Anarchist newspaper magazine in 1962 wrote an article, and they described the kibbutzes as eerie microcosm, maybe seeing the beginnings of what might happen in a genuinely free society. Now, as their comrades will be aware of the ultimate failure of the kibbutz experiment, I mean, a socialistic experiment within an ocean of capitalism, it's very difficult to succeed. I mean, by the late 70s, even like collective upbringing had actually finished in a lot of the kibbutzes. And also in the late 70s, a right-wing government under Menachem Begin came to power after 30 years of Labour government. And then there was a financial crisis in the Israeli economy in the 1980s, which led to massive inflation, and basically the kibbutzes were in phenomenal debt. And what we've had is privatisation of a lot of the kibbutzes and differential salaries introduced. Although there are still a few who actually live this egalitarian way. The Raven, an anarchist quarterly magazine in 1995, said, for anarchists and old-fashioned socialists, I don't know if that first was or not, the kibbutz movement in Palestine was an example of how people could live and work together without the state, the boss, and the incentives of capitalism. Toilet training in the 1960s in the kibbutz. Dear Ronnie, I don't know if anybody saw the 1980s series A Very Peculiar Practice. And one of the characters in that, the GP in that, was always referring to R.D. Lang as Dear Ronnie. Basically, he led an investigation into families of schizophrenics. Sorry to like not to moon away too much from family and class society. But basically, families of schizophrenics. And he was just interested in how a person basically went mad. And he saw it inside the family. He basically saw that his impression was that comparing the families of schizophrenics with other families is that they are relatively closed systems. The future patient is particularly enclosed within the family system. And this is the implication, is that families cause madness. Now, it's very controversial and very popular as well at the same time. In an interview he gave in 1977, R.D. Lang, responding to criticism that he was attacking the family, said, "My attack on the family is aimed at the way I felt many children are subjected to gross forms of violence of their rights, to humiliation at the hands of adults who don't know what they're doing." In a book he wrote called The Politics of Experience, he wrote, "From the moment of birth, when the Stone Age baby confronts the 20th century mother, the baby is subjected to forces of outrageous violence called love, as its mother and father have been, and their parents before them. The family is mainly concerned with destroying most of its potentialities. This enterprise is, on the whole, successful. By the time the new human being is 15 or so, we are left with a being like ourselves, a half-crazed creature, more or less adjusted to a mad world. This is normality in our present age." His son, Adrian, says Ronnie's politics were partly from the 16th century French Renaissance philosopher Étienne de la Boétie, who basically attacked tyranny and theorised about obedience and domination. And to this philosopher of the 16th century, the greatest mystery of politics was obedience to rulers. Again, there's a reference here to basically to Spinoza and Reich again. Why in the world do people agree to be looted and not otherwise oppressed by government overlords? In The Positive Experience, Lang also writes, "We are born into a world where alienation awaits us. We are potentially human beings, but we are in an alienated state, and this state is not a natural system." I think you get the gist of R.D. Lang there. I'm going to like miss out David Cooper now, because basically he's really rehashing what R.D. Lang is saying, and also I'll be repeating myself. This book, Anti-Oedipus, now this was a revelation to me. This is a thoroughgoing critique of Freudian psychoanalysis, and basically saying it's reactionary, the whole psychoanalysis from Freud. Basically, the figure of Oedipus and this whole concentration on it basically leads to enforcing neuroses as a way of life within capitalism. And these are the two guys who wrote this book, published in 1972. They refer to an incident in just after the 1968 May uprisings in Paris. Some psychoanalysts of the Paris section of the International Psychoanalytic Association, writing under pseudonyms, published a few books. One was called The Universe of Conflict, and another one was called The Revolt Against the Father. Basically, they argued that the leftist protesters of May 1968 were totalitarian Stalinists, and they psychoanalyzed them as suffering from a sordid infantilism caught up in an Oedipal revolt against the father. Now, who needs enemies when you've got friends like those? And they're supposed to be psychoanalysis, Freudian psychoanalysis. And basically, they're like doing the job of the basically the De Gaulle French capitalist state. Okay, well, within capitalism, there's Oedipus Rex, Woody Allen's take on the dominant mother. Pasolini's Oedipus Rex, again, and there he is, after blinded himself. I mean, Deleuze and Guattari refer to Oedipus, it's the marshy earth that gives off a powerful odour of decay and death, and it is castration, the pious ascetic wound, signifying that makes of this death a conservatory for the Oedipal life. So family values, you know, I mean, in capitalism, I mean, capitalism, I mean, it fosters the family ideology, but while simultaneously undermining it. I mean, all the inner family tensions caused by unemployment, forcing women to go to work, basically, undermines the family to begin with straight away. And also, they heap all the burdens on families. I mean, the Fawcett Society took the government to judicial review in 2010, saying that women were disproportionately affected by austerity. And as we know, the capitalist market basically absorbs sexual needs and turns everything into a profitable business venture. You know, I mean, sex is commodified everywhere. Pornography, raunch culture, gay lifestyles, the pink pound. Basically, family and marriage is a social institution that encourages emotional possessiveness and psychological enslavement. I mean, family and class society determines our attitudes to sexuality, gender and sex. It enforces sexual conformity and gender roles. I mean, the development of capitalism in the 18th century into the 19th century basically destroyed the family as an institution in the working class. But the bourgeois basically took steps to strengthen the institution legally and ideologically. I mean, David Cooper, who I skipped over earlier, actually said the family, before the mid-18th century, before the mid-18th century, it didn't come into the life of an individual, only on occasions of crisis within life or after death. Only since the mid-18th century has the family invaded the day-to-day life of its members. I mean, in 1753, a marriage act was passed and basically abolished common law marriages. Before 1753, a man and a woman, by verbal agreement, would become married. And this act of Parliament basically made it valid. A marriage had to take place in a church. And basically it also removed a woman's right to property, income, and basically children, and became a property of the husband. And also, before this act was passed, if a couple, the woman became pregnant, de facto, they were seen as married, and even clergy actually looked on their offspring as legitimate. But basically, this all finishes in 1753, which is basically at the time of the Industrial Revolution. I mean, in the 19th century, we get a real strengthening of the family. In women's places in the home, there are attacks on any variations outside the home. Homosexuality is actually defined for the first time in 1869. It's actually criminalised even further in 1885 with an amendment to an Act of Parliament which basically coined a new clause, gross indecency between men. This became known as the Blackmailer's Charter and was only repealed in 1967. Also in the 19th century, prostitution was widespread. It was at its peak. It was an age where a woman was sacred, but where you could buy a 13-year-old girl for a few pounds. And there were more churches built than in the whole previous history of the country, but where one in 60 houses in London was a brothel. And the 1857 Metropolitan Police reported there were nearly 10,000 prostitutes working in London. Now, trying to get a figure on how many prostitutes are working in Britain today is very difficult, but I mean, we could be looking at a figure of 100,000 women are actually engaged somehow in prostitution. I mean, at the same time in the Victorian period, the sanctity of marriage and premarital chastity was proclaimed from every pulpit and newspaper editorial. Basically, relationships, because this is what this weekend's about. I mean, I've been subject to lots of reform and counter-reforms. I mean, I've been talking quite a bit about sex education at some point in this talk. I mean, sex education, even today, in schools in this country, is not compulsory for children. Parents can actually refuse to let their children attend lessons. And I believe that discussion about relationships is actually quite neglected, and we do have the highest teenage pregnancy rate in Europe. As comrades will be aware, I mean, abortion was legalised in 1967 with a limit placed at 28 weeks. But that's actually been lowered to 24 weeks in 1990. And there's always several private members' bills going through the House of Commons to actually lower it even further. Gay relationships, they were legalised again in the 1960s. The age of consent is now equal. But interestingly enough, now we've got a Tory government pushing a gay marriage bill through Parliament. Again, he's actually strengthening the institution of the family. This is in contrast, obviously, to the 1980s, when the media and the Tory government were very homophobic, and Section 28 was described as the first piece of specifically anti-gay legislation since 1885. Members, comrades will be aware of that. Again, the contraceptive pill introduced for married couples in the 1960s is free on the NHS, but there's been controversy about that. A woman called Victoria Gillick, people will maybe remember her from the 1980s, she campaigned to prevent doctors prescribing pills, the pill to under 16s without parental consent. I mean, she was defeated in the High Court, but then later the law was actually ruled only in exceptional circumstances would that actually take place. So, I mean, family values. I mean, that is just like a term that never seemed to actually exist, but it's now way quite popular. I mean, in the 1980s, Thatcher's Tory government was very big on family values. Norman Tebbit would attack valueless values and the poisoned legacy of the permissive society. In 1992, John Major introduced Back to Basics Family Values Campaign, and that just sank in a morass of Tory sleaze, double standards and scandal. Interestingly enough, David Cameron attacked Tony Blair in 2000 for abolishing Section 28, saying it was anti-family, which supposed to actually ties in with today because he's actually pursuing gay marriage, which is, again, strengthening the family. I mean, I was talking a bit about sort of psychotherapy earlier. I mean, from what I know about it, I mean, the working class gets cognitive behaviour therapy, CBT. Comrades may be aware of it. Basically, it just ensures that the working class are actually mentally fit enough to work. The government actually put loads of money into this. They have done since 2008. Lots of money have been put into it. Basically, it's short six-week courses of therapy. So basically, to just get you back to work. I think it's at least the wealthy will be able to afford your Freudian psychoanalysis or even some Reichian analysis. So Engels, in The Origin, he talked about, well, what would it be like in socialism, basically, in our post-class society. I mean, he wrote in The Origin of the Family, Property and the State, we are now approaching a social revolution in which the economic foundations of monogamy, as they have existed hitherto, will disappear, just as surely as those of its complement prostitution. Monogamy arose from the concentration of considerable wealth in the hands of a single individual man and from the need to bequeath this wealth to the children of that man and no other. So having arisen from economic causes, will monogamy then disappear when these causes disappear? Will we bring about a gradual growth of unconstrained sexual intercourse? Will the traditional bonds of sexual relations, like all fetters, be shaken off? I mean, the position of all women must undergo a significant change. With the transfer of the means of production into common ownership, a single family ceases to be the economic unit of society. Private housekeeping is transformed into a social industry. The care and education of the children becomes a public affair. Society looks after all children alike. So in conclusion, Engels said, well, we'll most definitely disappear from monogamy. First, the dominance of man, and secondly, marriage. That's family in class society. That's it.
Thanks, Zeef, for that wonderful talk. Can I open up for questions now? Mike, would you like to say something about...
Not so much at all. Sorry, I forgot, you wanted to say something. Very interesting information there. It was just a point of information really about the social there. As we all know, Burkhoff's at Alcohol Free. So I reserved a space at the pub down the road from 9 o'clock. What I was going to suggest, we obviously need time for discussion here. So I was going to maybe go there about 9:30. I'm happy to ferry people there. But we might need taxis. And it's about 10 minutes walk down the road, so it's within staggering distance. So I'm happy to drop people off there, but so I'll be drinking alcohol, maybe order taxis later on. But the pub's okay. The bit that sections off, it's not quiet, so there will be a bit of noise. I've been in there, pacing the joint on Friday and Saturday, and you can't expect yourself to it. So what I'd suggest is maybe a break in the discussion about 9:30. If anyone wants to go off to the pub, then I'll lead the way. Otherwise, there are some soft drinks, which are probably rather warm as have been left in my car for the past couple of hours. But you're welcome to use the downstairs area. I was going to be locking this room after the session finishes.
Yeah, no, I agree very much with the overall tenor of the discussion. You know, I wouldn't be here if I didn't think that I'm being a survivor of two marriages myself. You know, is the way in which a marriage is a dysfunctional institution for the people who live within it. You know, and with the children often, you know, sometimes it can be beneficial, but it's very risky, and it does inhibit people's growth. I just wanted to comment, and there's no way you couldn't have done it any other way, Steve, with the sort of potpourri of things you came in. But the summary dismissal of Freud, I have to say, I have some slight problems with, because I think at his time, the man who actually did talk about the unconscious and brought that into public debate, and the issues around repression, which could have been to do with societal forms and family patterns and the way in which that leads to neurosis, was a phenomenal insight at the time. And therefore, I think Freud was almost worth it from that point of view himself. And, of course, the split in psychoanalysis started with Jung having enormous problems with the Oedipus complex. And then I think the way in which modern psychoanalysis has moved into the humanist form, I think, is much more people-centred and supportive of the work of Carl Rogers and others. So I wouldn't throw out, although it has to be seen within a social context, I entirely agree with that. And then the other thing I just say about the kibbutz, it's a fascinating topic.
Yes.
I think in this country, actually, the work that the people, the one who started the Cotswold community, that progressive, approved school, I think it was at the time. Neil, but also within the public sector, I've forgotten his name now, who worked on the Cotswold community, and that was a similar kind of sort of upbringing for very damaged children to increase their potential. But there's some of the issues around all these, and Bettelheim himself in the book on Children of the Dream was concerned, wasn't he, about issues around attachment theory.
Yes.
And allowing children's development, but at the same time avoiding the perils of institutionalism, which we know takes place in group care of children, where there's a danger of it. So I think, well, it was a fascinating talk, and I'd just like to carry on discussing it most of the night, but that's a tribute to you starting those things. But some of these things, and you naturally had to do it, I think raise other questions and discussion, which makes it very rich. So thanks for the talk.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
I mean, you mentioned Anthony Lang very briefly, right? You know, he wrote his book on the family, and he only looked at 10 families. And to be honest, it caused a lot of grief, because a lot of mothers and fathers of schizophrenics were then blamed for the daughter or son's illness, right? You know, and that went on for a few years until it was decided that Anthony Lang was wrong. His study was only 10 dysfunctional families. And if you pick 10 so-called normal families, you'd find that they were just as dysfunctional as the ones with the schizophrenic or whatever. I mean, I suffer from schizophrenia. You know, I got it in 1988 when I was ill, and I'm on medication. If it was simply just dysfunctional family and not my brain chemistry, the drugs wouldn't work then, you know. And by and large, the drugs work then anyway. You also mentioned William Wright, who ended up dying in a psychiatric hospital. And he was very homophobic, right? You know, he was very critical of homosexuals. I read a book where he was saying that they were all fascists, and part of the Nazis' thing was to be homosexual and things. So there was just a few things I'd pick up. And I did enjoy your talk. I thought it was covering a lot of areas, and it was very interesting, yeah.
Should I respond to now? Thank you for your comments. Freud. I think originally Freud. Yeah, it's revolutionary, absolutely. I think it's the First World War, and like the experience of the First World War, and by the time he comes to write books at the end of the 1920s, Civilization and Its Discontents, he seems to see humanity in a really poor light. So I understand. But he does neglect social factors. I mean, and that's why I am really quite attracted to Wilhelm Reich in his psychoanalytic theory. I'm in correspondence with somebody because I've criticised Freud as well. And it's not you, is it?
No,
Because I haven't met the gentleman, you know. No, no, but yes, I need to respond to him. But yeah, I understand. You know, but I still think that basically he does say that sexual repression is actually needed for civilization. You know, for it to exist. So maybe he's saying it's necessary for bourgeois capitalist civilization to exist. But yeah, I take your point. You know, sometimes you know I might have thrown him all out. Yeah, the kibbutz experience I think, yeah, it's fascinating. And Bruno Bettelheim, yes, I read parts of his book. I got hold of a copy of it. And he did see that some people were having problems after they left the kibbutz, of actually forming relationships with people and, let's say, attachment theory. Yeah, I'm aware of that. Yeah, I mean, Ardy Lang... has suffered a lot of criticism since 1960s. He was very popular, wasn't he, for a brief time. And basically, his work actually just blames the family for all the things. I think a lot, like I say, a lot of his work has been debunked now. Wilhelm Reich, I mean, I've read that he was homophobic in some ways and equated homosexuals with fascists. But I mean, there were a number of leading fascists who were actually homosexual in the Third Reich. I mean, I didn't focus at all on anything that Wilhelm Reich wrote after the 1930s. I didn't want to start talking about orgone energy or orgone accumulators or anything like that. I didn't want to talk about that because that doesn't really refer to his Marxist period. So I just wanted to like strictly keep it up till say 1933 and not to what happened in America and stuff like that.
Bill?
Yeah. The stuff about mother rights, certainly among mainstream anthropology, is certainly frowned upon and not very well supported.
Yeah.
And certainly far away, the idea generally tends to be that a lot of the myths that were associated with it were in fact just that, myths. And there doesn't seem to be any evidence extant of any sort of matriarchal societies of that sort. And just on him again. I seem to remember a few years ago some articles in The Guardian where some of the mothers were writing about how hard their family had been separated from their children. As they say, it's almost forcibly. Although at the time, you think, well, actually, that is what happens.
Yes.
Now, for a lot of mothers who have to go out and work, but you see, it's done by a sort of a backdoor approach and without the ideological constraints. Because obviously, at the same time, the guts, part of the idea was that the women were needed to work. And they couldn't spare them for the child rearing as well.
I mean, this thing about matriarchal or matrilineal societies in the time of primitive communism, I mean, I always saying to think that bourgeois capitalism doesn't want us to even think that there was any sort of primitive communism ever existing and any sort of matriarchal societies existing. I mean, like all the Neolithic artwork that's been found is all of depictions of women. In my reading, suggests I am a great believer in the fact that there was some sort of, if not matriarchal, matrilineal society in primitive communism. Yeah, as regards the kibbutz, mothers being separated from their children. Yeah, even by the late 1970s, even before the privatisation of the kibbutzes, the collective upbringing of children had actually sort of ceased in a lot of the kibbutzes.
Any hands up? Bill, again, you first.
Just on the point about the primitive society now, I was reminded of, if anyone else has seen, A Cave of Forgotten Dreams, which is about in the 1990s, some French speleologists found a cave that had been sealed for 40,000 or so years with some early human paintings on the wall. And all the paintings were exclusively of animals, except for one protuberance, which was painted as the lower half of a woman merging into the upper half of a bull. And to which Werner Herzog, the director, says even then the aesthetics of Baywatch were predominant. certainly they have found awful lot of Ice Age society dolls of the sort that you found of the headless naked woman. I'm not sure how much that relates to necessarily a matrilineal society as such or a simple fertility print. I think it's the question that's open.
So, can that then, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, to what extent, and particularly like beginning of the 20th century, do you think all these Marxists were against family and against monogamous relationships, that was to do with like a reaction against the capitalist system rather than some sort of theoretically worked out system, with the idea that marriage and monogamy and family life was such an integral part of capitalism, they felt, and bourgeois society, they felt, that must be something they had to be opposed to.
Yeah, I would say, yeah. I think right from the beginning, Marx in the Manifesto, or even in the Paris manuscripts, he starts straight away, marriage is it's based on private property and it's based on capital. Basically, with the ending of capitalist relations of production, we'll have the social form of the family and marriage should disappear in a future social society.
In some of these primitive societies, they do have stable families and relationships, and which has got nothing to do with property relationships. It's this idea that families and monogamous relationships have to be something to do with capitalism and only develop from capitalism.
No, I think earlier I did, when I was talking about, say, sort of hunter-gatherer societies that are not based on capitalist social relations. There are sort of in that South American tribe, paternity is partitioned amongst men, so that women's children will be brought up by several fathers. That is obviously nothing to do with capitalism. Am I missing the point of what you're actually saying to me here?
Talking about monogamous relationships. What I'm saying is, I think you can have monogamous, families sort of thing, without it having to then do with property relationships and capitalism.
I don't know. I'm not sure. Richard?
Nice. Simon first.
I'm a bit worried. I mean, you're very much preaching nerves to the converted here. If you tell a story about sort of like communism and then feudalism, capitalism, and how it could be nice and great for yonder. I'm worried about any kind of thing that seems to make sense with that analysis for a start. That's just a straightforward. That's just me. I want to see data. I don't want to see stories. Yeah. So that's one thing that's worrying. However, there's something that would lead me to be more worried about this is that we're sticking it together, along with all these Freudians, etc., sticking it together arse backwards, because what we're doing is we're saying, well, there must be something fundamental about the concern with sex and etc., the concern with marriage, that goes all the way through society from its earliest point through to this point where its misery is perfected in the bourgeois marriage. Doesn't it make much more sense, looking at the analysts and the time they've come along, doesn't it make much more sense that we were just going about our day and fell into the trap of bourgeois marriage, which perfected this problem, that then led us to see all of the world and all of our past history through that prism? So should we not actually be obsessing about this? I mean, as Marx put it, you can look at the world any way you want. It's one of the reasons for his materialist approach, to say you can look at it any way you want, but what actually matters is how you make things, because how you produce the objects in the world, because those are the things that stay after you go, if you sort of mean. Those are the silent monuments to us. But the stories about ourselves, we can look at the world any way we like. Yeah. So I think what I'm trying to say is, well, we can stitch together this kind of story and can also try and stitch together some sort of golden future. Yeah. Maybe it's all a fantasy. Yeah. Maybe the only reason that we look at the world in that way is precisely because of the capitalist situation we're in. Yeah. And this is not some global application that we can make.
Richard.
I'm not sure how I can follow that, actually. I'm fairly stunned. I just wanted to make a few comments about early society. I think you have to be very, very careful, very, very careful indeed, when we talk about hunter-gatherers. Because hunter-gatherers is very much a catch-all term, which can be used and is used to describe a group of very different kinds of societies. In fact, anthropologists generally speak about tribal societies, they talk about chieftains, they talk about immediate return hunter-gatherer societies, and they talk about delayed return hunter-gatherer societies. Now, these differences actually relate to differences in stratification within those societies. None of them have a fully developed class system, but there are layers, there are degrees of status-bearing individuals within those societies. And the only ones that we know of that are really fully egalitarian are the immediate return hunter-gatherers, and there's not a huge number of those left. And if you look at those, so we're looking at, none of them are entirely egalitarian, none of them. But most of them are highly egalitarian, far more than perhaps even we would normally be able to sort of consider, imagine to ourselves in it from our, you know, non-egalitarian world. But within them, there is a huge variety of arrangements for marriage, for sexual relationships. You cannot say that create a propertyless society, which is based on sharing, which these societies are, that doesn't automatically give rise to a certain kind of set of marital or sexual relationship. For example, the Akha in sort of West Central Africa, men and women, for example, basically a marriage takes place when one decides to move in with another one, and a divorce takes place when they decide to move out. And it could be a woman decides to move in, it could be a man that decides to move in. There is no matchmaking as there is in some other kinds of society, and so on and so forth. In kind of slightly more stratified societies, in late return hunter-gatherers, you do get quite a lot of arranged marriages. But even there, the arranged marriages are complex. The person whose marriage is being arranged will probably have quite a lot of say in it, and there will be some complicated arrangements, so it's not sort of forced upon them. And that only applies for first marriages, because most of these societies have serial marriages. You will get married for a certain period of time, you will hang out children, probably sort of then get married or have a relationship with somebody else. As soon as you get stratification, which is most of the societies that Steve was talking about, tribal societies are not hunter-gatherers in that sense. Tribal societies have already started to develop sort of not exactly property, but certain kind of elements of ownership within them. And there are things called complex hunter-gatherers, which are even slave societies. So there is this kind of complicated arrangement. In those societies, you tend to get male dominance. So in all the stuff that I've read, I've not come across a purely matriarchal society. I've come across egalitarian societies at that sort of really basic hunter-gatherer level, and I've come across patrilineal and patriarchal societies, or societies which have elements of patriarchy in them, as we recognise it. But I haven't actually come across strictly matriarchal societies.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I was actually given the impression that in today's so-called hunter-gatherer societies there actually was matriarchal societies. I think what the South American tribe that I was referring to, I think I was referring to them because of the partitioning of paternity among several men. It's that sort of aspect of some of the hunter-gatherers societies, and also Malinowski's book on the savages, sexual lives of savages in Melanesia, is 1929 as well. And he wasn't actually saying it was matriarchal, he was saying it was matrilineal, But basically, I think what I was focusing on, or trying to focus on in my talk, was relationships. The relationships between between man and woman, or in American tribes, transgender or mixed gender relationships, in what were hunter-gatherer societies originally, and that sort of thing. So, yeah, the egalitarian side of things, and the fact that there weren't actual matriarchies. That was really what I was trying to focus on.
Can I just say, I wasn't actually responding to a lot of your talk because I actually missed the first part. Mm-hmm. I was actually more responding to what some other
people. You walked in when I was talking about hunter-gatherers, and I thought it was quite apt when you'd given a talk about that only a few months ago.
Really I'd like to say something about the Paleolithic period, actually. There's a good article by Camilla Power and Chris Knight on, I think it's called The First Lipstick. Basically, it's from about 100,000 years ago. They've discovered the first signs of women decorating their faces to make themselves more attractive. What they have theorised is that this was actually a form of gender struggle, if you like, that a lot of men would impregnate the women and bugger off. Mm. So what the women would do is go on sex strike, basically, until the other men provided for them and made sure that there was food coming in. And to add to it, they would wear makeup to make themselves look more attractive and more available, but then say no, basically. It's a very good article. It's worth reading.
I'll look into it.
Things
never
change.
Yeah.
Are they sure it's women that you wear your makeup? Archaeological stuff like that sort of tends to make great theories on minuscule amounts of evidence.
Anyone?
I'd like to discuss the impact of the deindustrialisation of Britain and heavy industry, and the women's impact on employment. How that is impacted on women's role in the family and children's, and just a point of interest, maybe. Today, that if you're unemployed and you receive unemployment benefit, they ask you if you're living with your partner as if you're married to them. And if you say yes, I mean, you get less money because obviously, you know, you're one. So that may impact. And one of my friends who's gay was living with a female friend of his, he had to have someone come to his house, literally, and identify, no, they're not living as a married couple, you know, and then they buggered off, you know, filled in their little clipboards and stuff.
I mean, as I was talking near the end of the talk about, I mean, in capitalism today, I mean that's it in a nutshell, isn't it? The contradictions and people having to prove they're in a relationship or not in a relationship just in order to get benefits. Yeah.
Any more questions? Richard?
If there's no more questions, just an amusing aside on that, what is now the DWP used to apply the marmalade test, that they used to look in the cupboards to see if there was one pot of marmalade in the room. That was an official way of deciding whether couples were cohabiting.
Can I correct that statement about something? I speak from experience. It was the two. If there were two toothbrushes in the bathroom, two men came and had a check that one. The 1980s.
Well, if there are no more questions, it's your last chance. I suggest we end it here. Yeah, thanks, Steve, for a wonderful talk.